And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
Henry David Thoreau said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." So it logically follows that if we want to preserve the world, we have to preserve wildness. 43 years ago, Congress created the Wilderness System to protect and preserve the wildness. In recent years, these and other public lands have been at the center of a fundamental tug of war between those who believe such places are meant to provide resources for profit and those who profit in other ways from their being preserved in their natural state. What is the state of the wilderness? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
I've come recently to have a new appreciation for wilderness. Why? Because if you take the time to think about it, wilderness, particularly as we have defined it in the United States, is the closest we have, and likely ever will have, to a manifestation of God, or truth, or the Great Spirit, or the divine plan, or a tribute to the natural law or natural selection, literally in the world. American wilderness holds the seeds of genetic diversity of our realm, diversity which is beginning to crash in the sprawling reaches of human development, and even in what was, until recently considered, the jungles of deepest Africa or along the Amazon. To be frank, what is needed suddenly around the world are comparable wildernesses where no roads are cut to allow the cutting of trees or the mining of minerals, where no one can live to slaughter gorillas or orangutans as bushmeat. Had we set up oceanic wildernesses much earlier, the sanctity of its diversity might still be intact. Large fish and whales could live within the natural rhythms of life that have allowed us all to know of them, even if, perhaps a few generations on, they will thrill us only in legends and museum mounts, in old DVDs, films, and stories. Wilderness is the repository of the truths of our existence, and a time may come when we redefine what it means to talk about the spirit of wilderness. It's conceivable that we may, in the future, turn to wilderness as a sacred place in which the greatest wisdom, power, and magic of the universe live. And it may be that a time comes when we unite with its deepest truths, once again, as we have in the past, through the great legacy of naturalists, transcendentalists, and writers, the Thoreaus and Emersons, Whitmans, Carsons, Muirs, who expressed this truth and helped to enshrine wilderness when there was a chance to speak freely from the soul of humankind. So today we take a look at what is happening to the wilderness movement with one of its deepest apostles, Mike Matz, executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. That will be coming up in segment two of today's show following the Weekly Earth Summit. Coming up in just a moment, we get an update from Donna Buckby from Rushford, Minnesota, one of the towns devastated by the torrential rains and floods exactly 1 month ago. Donna continues to share the recovery of this Midwestern American town as it tries to restore itself enough to endure the oncoming winter that in that part of the states is already being felt. That's all coming up. But first, we bring you this week's edition of the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is your host, Sidney Wildsmith, and we continue to get updates from our exceptional panel of experts in science, advocacy, and nature. The world is a complex place, as you'll certainly learn in the upcoming news report. And those of us who work and dedicate our lives to keeping this whole thing going sometimes need to take a look at that age-old question, do the ends justify the means? It's a value judgment, but a newly activating advocate is taking a personal stand to do the right thing. So I want to begin today's summit with Ben Lowe. Ben?
I've got a confession. I love to travel. I love going to new places, experiencing cultures, meeting people. I've hopped an airplane for about 6 round trips each year in college. Last summer, I flew over to Tanzania. There's nothing unusual about this. My generation really gets around. We now have unprecedented access to all parts of the globe, and we've taken advantage of these opportunities. We'll hop a plane at the slightest excuse. This summer, one of my roommates is in Russia, the other's in the West Bank. I have friends and classmates that are in almost any country you can think of, even places like Sudan and Tibet. But we really need to rethink this travel happy trend, and it needs to start with me. First off, I need to figure out how to cut back on all this flying, really cut back. Then I need to consolidate meetings and road trips so that they accomplish more on less energy. When possible, I need to take trains or buses. As an environmentalist, I am convicted that it's time for me to clean up my own act and set a good example. After all, it sure seems hypocritical to be burning up the earth by flying to a meeting to talk about saving the earth.
Thanks, Ben. And in that same vein, I'm proud to announce that the weekly Earth Summit has one of the lowest carbon footprints of any global forum, as our guests travel here and speak to you each week without having to even drive a tenth of a mile to do so. Now that's keeping our eye on the message. And speaking of eyes, I recently talked with Dr. Mark Beckhoff about the power of eye contact in communicating with animals, and Mark has offered to share his observations. Dr. Beckhoff.
One of the things you mentioned about that interaction is eye contact, and I think that that is very, very important. You know, sometimes you can invite interaction, and other ways you could repel it by direct staring of the eyes. But I think when you relax your eyes and you roll them around and sometimes you move your head very slowly, that also is an invitation to interact friendly. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a play signal, but that's another thing I've done with cats is, especially with cats who I don't know, basically you can look at them, you can break eye contact, you can roll your eyes around and certainly not stare them directly head on. And it's fascinating how you can get them to do that.
We're going to keep up our dialogue on animals and their wonderful abilities with Dr. Beckhoff in the months ahead. Animals and their amazing diversity and behaviors has a champion in Dr. Robin D. Moore with Conservation International, who invites you to join him in his efforts to awaken the world to the plight of the amphibians. Please welcome Dr. Moore.
New Zealand contains only 4 living species of frog. 3 species have already gone extinct. Those surviving species are among the world's most ancient amphibians, having remained virtually unchanged for around 200 million years. They are unusual in that they communicate using chemicals and only have limited hearing ability. They very rarely swim, but when they do not kick their legs in time like most frogs. These frogs are restricted to small areas of native forests in the North Island of New Zealand. They are, like a third of amphibians around the world, threatened with extinction. The good news is that they're the subject of an intensive conservation effort, which is having some success at reversing trends. An awareness-raising campaign is informing the public about these bizarre creatures, and the creation of reserves and habitat restoration is protecting their habitat. As a result of these efforts, a new population of one species has been found, and other populations do appear to be expanding. These successes speak to the value of a truly collaborative effort among scientists, zoos, and local groups, and serves as a model for projects elsewhere. To learn more about this and other amphibian news, you can read Froglog, the bi-monthly newsletter of the Amphibian Specialist Group. This is available at www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Please do visit his website. If you've not ventured into the wonders of the amphibians, it's definitely time you did. We're always pleased to hear from Dr. Charles Kennel. This week, Dr. Kennel applies his penetrating perspective to remind us all that there are no simple answers. Dr. Kennel.
I think the most important thing is that if you are worried about the next 100 years on our planet, then you'll need to predict how our global environment is going to evolve. And the minute you do that, you begin to understand how interconnected all the parts of the Earth system are. You can start any place in the Earth system and go around the loop. The oceans transport heat from the tropics to the poles, and that this ocean transport of heat is one of the major drivers of climate. Some of this energy gets into the atmosphere and powers the storms and the freshwater cycle. The sun shines down on the oceans and atmospheres and warms them and is the ultimate driver of climate. The parts and pieces are tied together. And when we start interacting with the climate, we do so on a global and interconnected basis. When we put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, it spreads completely around the Earth and blends in with the contributions of everybody else on the planet who are burning fossil fuels. And this carbon dioxide then heats the globe. On an average basis, the temperature is rising 1 or 2 tenths of a degree per decade. But that masks the interconnectedness of the parts of the climate. Some parts of the world are going to get drier. Others, particularly the tropics, may get wetter. There will be more energy circulating in the climate system. People now think that while the number of storms may remain approximately the same, they will probably get more intense over time. As we warm the surface of the Earth, the glaciers are retreating, the snow melts in our mountains are retreating, and the snow cover is retreating. And we're affecting the freshwater cycle through the melting of ice. The melting of freshwater that has been on land, such as in Greenland and Antarctica, when that gets into the ocean, that is beginning to contribute to the rise of sea level. When sea level rises, our coastal environments and our beaches and our beachside cliffs and our homes become more vulnerable. And it isn't only the few centimeter per decade sea level rise that we've seen that makes all the difference. It's when the sea level rises in the background and great storms cause storm surges to go across our land. I was just in England, and a good deal of London is only 2 or 3 meters above sea level. And so we have chosen to build much of our civilization next to the sea. 50% of the world population lives within 100 miles of the ocean. And so most of our human activity is taking place just where the sea is about to encroach on all that we have done. When we burn fossil fuels and other fuels inefficiently, we create smog and aerosol particles. And the natural winds pick them up, and they transport them across the ocean. When there's a major smog event in Beijing, it arrives off the coast of California. About a week or so later, we can detect all of those particles in our atmosphere, and at those times, they are three-quarters of California's upper air pollution. When the winds blow off the desert, in Africa, and they transport sand and dust to the islands of Jamaica, there's a rise in pulmonary diseases and asthma. And so our entire world is interconnected in ways that we had no idea until we started studying it at the Earth system as a whole in the last 50 years. And it is clear to us that nature has created a greater interconnection amongst its parts than we have as a human civilization. And it's the fracturing of our civilization and the lack of communication and understanding and the inequality around the world that gets in the way of our being able to stabilize the environment of this great planet so that we can live on it as a harmonious civilization for centuries to come. Nature is more integrated and more tied together than we are.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I look forward to hearing from you each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Sometimes it's hard to know if we're making enough progress to meet these challenges. We're all glad to know that the faith-based communities are awakening to a renewed sense of responsibility to care for the gift of life on Earth in its broadest sense. Dr. Matthew Sleeth announces a personal milestone on his path to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
The big change for me is now being the U.S. director of this Christians in Conservation. AROCHA, which is capital A, capital R-O-C-H-A. AROCHA means the rock in Portuguese. And the tagline has always been Christians in Conservation. In the United States, we're moving the tagline to be the title, Christians in Conservation. It's in 16 countries, and there's like three or four more pending right at the moment. But it's everywhere from Kenya to Brazil to India to UK, Canada, United States. In the U.S., it developed as a way to send money to the other AROCHA sites around the world. But there wasn't really a vision for what it was going to do here. In other countries, it does a lot of field biology work. They rescue estuaries, things like that. And in the United States, there's some of that going on. There's a project in Washington State. The blueberry crops are being decimated by starlings. And one of the AROCHA scientists figured out that you can use kestrels, which are really territorial, to chase off the starlings and not have to use any poisons and that sort of thing. And in the U.S., they've had a board. They've had great members and lots of very generous people, but they haven't had somebody with a vision of where it should go in the U.S. I've taken up the job of leading that organization in the United States, and there's just great people with a great vision, and they love to combine science and conservation and their faith of Christianity. And that's what's up and new with me, and it's a challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. And I get emails from all over the world now, people, you know, pulling for us and praying for us here. And that's encouraging to realize how big this family that not only shares my faith, but my love of the creation is.
Many people are joining this effort to serve the Earth for various reasons. Some because they've sensed the need. Some because they're becoming adults and the world is theirs if they can keep it. To them, and to all of us, there is so much to learn. Dave Foreman now joins us to offer his years of devoted study and focus his attention on a great new book about wilderness. Dave?
I'm going to be a little different this week and give a book review. I'm a great lover of conservation books. I have about 3,000 in my library. And on the Rewilding website, rewilding.org, we have a feature called Books of the Big Outside, where I give short reviews of the most important conservation books around. We have about 350 books listed right now. And I also do Uncle Dave's six-pack of the best books recently. And for last year, 2006, the book that won the best conservation book of 2006, in my opinion, was The Last Great Wilderness, the campaign to establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay. I envy my friend Roger Kay. As a wilderness manager and the bush pilot for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, he has had wilderness experiences most of the rest of us can only dream about. Knowing our flagship wilderness in all seasons and moods has led him into thinking deeply, perhaps more deeply than any living person, about the host of values wilderness holds. Roger's deep exploration of wilderness values comes through in The Last Great Wilderness. I read the book on a 3-week canoe trip in the Arctic Refuge last year and was mightily impressed. In a short review such as this, I cannot begin to do justice to the book. But let me point out just several features of the book that make it a standout. Arctic Wilderness is the detailed history of the decade-long campaign in the 1950s to set aside a big chunk of northeastern Alaska as some kind of wilderness preserve. In recounting that history, Roger plumbs the values that captivated and drove the various conservationists, giving us the most intelligent and thoughtful review of wilderness values in print. Conservation histories too often focus on the same cast of well-known, to literate conservationists anyway, characters. For example, Olus and Marty Murie are seen just about by everyone as the leaders and key players in that campaign for the Arctic. Roger gives the Muries their due, but brings out the other worthies of the campaign too, particularly Lowell Sumner and George Collins of the National Park Service. the two greatest conservationists of the 20th century that you never heard of. And beyond the big players, Roger gives grassroots activists center stage. Quoting extensively from them, he shows that Alaskans, like bush pilots Jenny Wood and Celia Hunter, were original wilderness thinkers who didn't need to rely on experts. And he shows that hunters in Alaska in the lower 48 were a significant force behind protection. Roger also gives a fair portrayal of the opponents of protection, insightfully showing how the opponents and supporters use competing concepts of the last frontier to bolster their arguments. In order to showcase such views, Roger's research involved reading personal letters, hearing records, letters to the editor, and conducting interviews with still living folks on all sides. What interested me most, though, was how Roger discussed values. Evolution was the key thing to be protected in the eyes of Sumner and Collins. They and others saw that only an immense wild region could protect the ongoing process of evolution and all of its building blocks. Quote, Sumner expressed the hope that this place might always have, quote, freedom to continue, unhindered and forever if we are willing, the particular story of planet Earth unfolding here, where its native creatures can still have freedom to pursue their future, so distant, so mysterious. Do read The Last Great Wilderness.
Be sure to check out Dave's critique of over 300 books about nature and the environment on the Rewilding website at www.rewilding.org. A reminder that the Weekly Earth Summit is open now to anyone out there who has something important to say about nature, the environment, and the future of this planet. If you wish to share your voice here, contact me at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. You too can be heard on the most important 15 minutes on Earth. It was almost exactly a month ago that Rushford, Minnesota was hit by some devastating floods that resulted from unusual torrential rains. At the time, we talked with Donna Buckby, who lives in Rushford, Minnesota, but not the high country up in the hills surrounding the town. She hadn't really had a chance to get down to the town to see what the damage was. She was preparing for that. And then we followed that up with a report a week later, where we heard what had happened to the town, and here we are a month out. And I want to follow this story because the restoration of a town, Midwestern town, like Rushford, I think is an important story because I don't think it's the last time we're going to hear about this as we look at the potential changes in climate, et cetera, coming from climate change. So, Donna Buckby, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, Donna, it has been a month, and I'm just curious if you were to summarize where things are, and we're going to go into more details, what really stands out for you?
Well, I guess it's amazing for me just to see the categories of debris that can be taken out of a building. It changes from day to day and week to week, and they haul all that away, and you think, okay, that's done, and people can start rebuilding or actually tearing down their homes if they've been condemned. But then, no, then more stuff is brought out, and there's piles up and down the streets, and they haul that away. But now I'm seeing a lot of duct work and cement blocks and brick and flooring and lath and ceiling tiles. So hopefully this will be the end of it, and the debris will have been hauled away, and then the real reconstruction can begin, or else the final demolition will start. Mm-hmm.
Give us a, by the way, let's review for people who perhaps haven't followed this from the beginning. Rushford, the population, and then how many buildings and homes were seriously impacted by the storm?
Well, Rushford has about 1,500 people, and there are slightly over 700 homes in Rushford. And I've heard anywhere that 150 to 275 homes are going to have to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So about a third of the
yes.
A third, yeah. Well, that's a lot. That's a lot in a little tiny town like that.
It's devastating for the town, and everyone is living in so much with so much uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And you had talked about that winter was coming. Mentioned that a couple weeks ago, and there was a frost late last week, and that put the fear of God into everybody.
Well, it does, because you die.
Yes. Well, people do have homes to live in now. They've all found relatives to stay with, or they've got trailer homes or temporary housing, or they're being put up in apartments. But if the homes are gutted, and you can see right through some of the homes, and they're, if these homes are going to be ready for winter, their time is not on our side right now. We could have a early winter.
Where are you in that process? So that's interesting. You talked about the process of clearing out all the debris. This is a process of kind of getting the homes ready, homes and other structures ready for rebuilding. Are you nearing the point where you can actually start? I imagine some homes are. It depends on the situation. But are you reaching that point?
Yes. The look of the town is changing. And now, instead of people coming in to do the grunt work and hauling out the debris, now there's a need for more skilled labor. So the sheetrockers and carpenters and plumbers and electricians are coming in.
Now, they would have to be coming in from outside the community, wouldn't they?
Well, no, some of the people are local.
Right.
And that's preferable, although there are people coming in from other parts of the state and the country, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this is paid work yet, I'd like to know, or if they're donating their services.
One of the things about people in small communities is that people have real expertise and can do a lot of the work, the carpentry, the plumbing, the sheetrocking, but it sounds like you've really got a lot of work there, so I can't imagine that your local population could really handle all that work.
Oh, no. No, it would take too long. People mm-hmm. need help from the outside.
How's it coming along? And then also, how in the world is this being financed?
Well, no, there are still lots of, tons of volunteers coming from all over the state and all over the country, and even some people from around the world are coming to help and donate money. A group of Buddhists came in from Taiwan a couple weeks ago and were handing out just cash to people if they could show that they were truly residents of the city and been damaged. But no, there's still tons of volunteers coming in, and I'm going, like I told you, I'm going down to the kitchen at the Catholic Church. It was the only kitchen in town that was left unscathed, and so they're feeding all the volunteers and the people in town who don't have electricity or running water. The town is full of volunteers still. One of the things I want to tell you, the parents in town have been told not to let their kids play in the grass because it's contaminated. But then also, the dust in town, when the wind comes and kicks up the dust, my friend Bob said, Donna, that dust isn't just dust. So we're concerned that there's going to be health issues down the road.
Hmm. So are people wearing face masks and things like that?
There are people living in town. There are kids out in the playground. The school is running. I'm not sure that was the wisest thing to do, but kids are out in that playground.
Well, you know, I can recall growing up in the Midwest, you never wanted to really stand out and feel and be awkward. You didn't want to be the odd man out. And so I can imagine kids just really won't wear face masks.
Kids aren't wearing particle masks, no.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
And I can only advise them, if they're listening, to do so, because I'll tell you what, as you get older, that's when it comes back to haunt you. Some of these dangers take years to develop and show themselves. So if you get it, just go ahead and do it. You know, it's really important. It just really is. They certainly learned that after the 9/11 disaster and the workers there and other places too. You know, so that's important information. When we last talked, you were trying to figure out how in the world to get food to your town because the grocery store was down. What's the status on your store?
It's going to be rebuilt. They're working on it right now, and I think the shelves are going to go in early October, and they might be up and running in another month and a half. This is wonderful news. And one of the restaurants has opened. The Subway is open, and I think Judy's restaurant is going to be opening maybe in a month and a half.
So how do you get your food? What's the process of that? You have to bring it in then?
There are lavish donations of food that are brought to the kitchen at the Catholic Church, which is feeding maybe 1,000 to 1,500 people a day.
A day?
Yeah, a day. Oh, it's amazing to be working down there. But there are buses taking people down to a town about 30 miles south of here to go grocery shopping. So people go to Winona, I'm going to Houston.
Well, it's obvious to me, and I can recall growing up in small, literally small towns, 410 people in Woodville, Wisconsin, for example, High Woodville. There was a pace to life there that was really very precious, but it sounds as if that's totally disrupted at this point in your town.
Absolutely.
If there is a focus on this recovery, what are some of the main areas that the town is really addressing? I'm curious, first of all, you need help. What is coming through at this point? You've talked about the volunteers. You've talked about the fact that some Buddhists are handing out money, but you need a lot of help. What help is coming through at this point, besides that?
A week ago, there was a special session. Governor Pawlenty was loath to call this special session, but there was so much pressure brought to bear on him from the people in the area and our legislators that there was a special session. I want to thank Ken Jumper, our representative to the State House, for all the work he did, because he got an aid package, a relief package that is the biggest and the fastest to hit the ground in the history of the state. And he also reminded Minnesotans, he said, this state was built on investments and not tax cuts. So the money is here. Now what we're worried about is that Pawlenty is going to make people jump through hoops. These loans that were going to be forgivable loans if people stayed in the area, now maybe they're not going to be forgiven loans. And so we're working on protecting the people and making sure that the locals get to decide how that money is spent.
Well, if we look back to New Orleans, where the devastation happened, and there are so many hoops, people are all tangled up, they don't know what to do. You know, this is not your fault. I just have to believe that someone understands that you people just plain need to restore your place, and red tape is inappropriate at this point. What do you think the package is that will come through?
The local people need to demand that they have access to that money, and they should have forgivable loans. But it was $157 million from the state legislature, and I'm so glad that there were enough people in the legislature at this point in time, people who cared about funding the common good rather than people care about tax breaks. But $157 million from the state and maybe another $50 million from the federal government to pay for roads and bridges, but there's going to be a new septic system put in town, a new sewage system. The historic buildings are going to be protected. There's going to be debris removal paid for and reconstruction paid for, inventory replaced, wells checked and wells replaced too.
In terms of the aid package, $157 million, is that for Rushford or is that for the state?
That is for southeast Minnesota.
No kidding.
And then there was some other, like drought relief for other communities, and then there was the fire, the big fire up in the Boundary Waters.
Hmm.
So that is shared, but the vast majority of that will be coming here.
Mm-hmm. That really doesn't sound like very much.
It doesn't sound like very much, but
it's a start.
It's a start, yeah. And in fact, the legislators who came down to talk about the relief package said that this, we're with you for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. The news cycles, it might be done with Rushford mm-hmm. in a week or two, but we're going to be with you through the long haul, and this is just a start. And that when this regular session starts, we can revisit this. We will revisit this, and this is just a start.
For those people who literally are homeless or their homes are unlivable, where are they now, and how are you handling that?
Well, I put my name on a list to receive people into my home if they needed a place. But I know so many people in town who are putting up relatives in their home. I talked to a woman yesterday who had 17 relatives in her very small home without running water and without electricity, and they were there for a week. They've all found other temporary housing now. But that story is repeated throughout the area.
That paints a picture.
Yeah.
That really does.
17 people, relatives staying in their home.
I'm good for maybe two or three relatives for 3 days with running water and all the amenities.
Yeah.
You know, I saw some great photos on the internet by Goodmanson. That's a good name from the Midwest there. And I have a link on the website. This was taken actually the day after the floods to show some of the damage. One of the things I noticed was there were any number of cars lying around that were impacted. I'm just curious, what can you tell us about the vehicles in the flood?
Well, I don't know how many were ruined, but I did hear just a few days ago that some of the cars and other, say, appliances, if people didn't try to start them up, that they could be salvaged. Some of them, parts of them could be salvaged and maybe even repaired. But if people were foolish enough to, well, I would have done it, to try to start the car up, it was ruined then because all that water got into the system. But they're going to be used for parts.
I noticed the silos, for example, that may have been impacted, and I imagine they're, you know, the silos are the mainstay of your community there. What's the status on the silos and damage there?
Well, one of the silos actually sort of exploded. It had dry soybeans in it, and the water got in at the bottom, and it expanded and just blew the whole thing apart. It's a steel silo. So I'm assuming that a lot of the crops, if they were in those silos, they were ruined.
Well, looking ahead here, we're going to keep talking with you on a regular basis because this is it's a real-life drama that's being enacted. At this point, what do you see, let's say, in the next week or two? What's going to be the focus? And I imagine it changes every single week.
It does. It changes from day to day. Well, they already have cut back at the kitchen. Instead of having three hot meals a day, they're having cold continental breakfast and then soup and sandwiches at lunch, and they're still doing a dinner. But they're kind of cut that back, and I think it's kind of sad because it's so important for the community to come together in this huge dining room and for people to share their stories and be supportive and just share information about what's needed and what's available. So it feels like a loss to me that the kitchen is going to be kind of cutting back. But then as the kitchen closes down, the restaurants in town will reopen, so things will be getting back to normal in that respect, but people's lives have been so disrupted. All the social networks are kind of crazy at this point. So I'm going to miss working in the kitchen, and I think a lot of people will miss having the kitchen there.
But if you have to go to a restaurant, and this is not a criticism, but I mean, if you have to go to a restaurant, then you have to pay. People who had jobs, how are they managing financially?
And I know exactly what you're talking about, but then I think they're feeling that, well, then when the businesses open up again, we want them making money again and to try to recoup their losses. But so I understand that part of it. But I think there's some people in town who are worried that this is maybe feeling a little too communistic, or people are getting too dependent on this big kitchen. And but really, it's a wonderful gathering place, and it really sustains people emotionally.
Mm.
Where does the money come from to buy? I don't know.
I've lived at many different levels in my life, and there were times when money for a meal was something that could be hard to find, you know, particularly if you were out of work, you know.
Right.
And so I just have to believe that there's people who are trying to figure that out every day of their life. And there's very proud people, too. And asking for help is not something that's easily done.
You know, it was very difficult for some of the people in Rushford to accept help and to have volunteers come through. Some people were angry with the volunteers at first because they just did not want to be receiving help and they didn't want the financial aid. But I think that's changing. I just think people need to realize that, you know, tomorrow you're going to be helping someone else out. And in the past, surely you helped someone else out who was in need. And so today it's our turn.
Well, it's a fascinating drama. Is there any special need that you think people could help out Rushford with at this time?
Well, you could send money to the Rushford Flood Relief Fund, and you could send it to Rushford City Hall. And the zip is 55971.
Donna Buckby, we'll talk again soon. I imagine you have a busy day ahead of you.
I do.
Well, let's talk again soon.
All right, Sydney, thanks.
What's happening to America's wilderness these days? We bring you an important update with Mike Matz, Executive Director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness, when your Voice of the Earth continues. Here on the Wild Side News.
Ready to get down and dirty to help keep America beautiful? Bring family and friends out to clean and restore America's parks, rivers, and trails on National Public Lands Day, Saturday, September 29th. Meet up with over 100,000 volunteers coast to coast and lend your helping hands for America's lands. Make it a date. For information on volunteer efforts in your area, visit www.publiclandsday.org. A message from the National Environmental Education Foundation.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2004 marked the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act. a bold yet practical act to preserve America's finest wild places. Within these last 3 years, so much has changed on good old planet Earth that wilderness just may be taking on a significance few ever dreamed it would be. For wilderness is about to become the sacred shrines of the garden. In just a moment, we hear what's happening to the wilderness movement in America. Be prepared to be surprised as your voice of the earth goes in depth into the wilderness. Stay tuned. There are so many discussions of so many issues these days that confront us right up front. You know, global warming, the demise of species, which is astonishing. The discussion, for example, that Ebola is really a serious threat to the gorilla population on this planet. If we lost them, it's hard for me to imagine that we're really involved in witnessing this in our time. So other issues seem to be moving kind of off the radar screen a little bit, but there's a lot of reasons for that. And one of those that I think is really fascinating to take a look at is the topic of wilderness, which, of course, around the 40th anniversary was such a major event. But since then, it's kind of become a little more quiet. That doesn't mean that there isn't plenty going on. And as a matter of fact, part of the good news is that there's a terrific amount of success stories to report. And there's possibly no one better to bring us up to date on that than Michael Matz, who's the executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Mike, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thanks, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I hear that, first of all, there's some really good news, and that's the fact that you're looking at your fifth anniversary. Why don't you tell us about what that means to you and the people at the Campaign for America's Wilderness?
Sure, it is very exciting. We became the Campaign for America's Wilderness in October of 2002 and really got to roll up our sleeves and sink our teeth into these issues of trying to protect America's public lands for future generations. And I really do think that there's a cause for optimism here, Sydney. We've seen some remarkable progress in the last 5 years where, when we first started out, there was a bill for a wilderness bill for California, Colorado, and Nevada, and that was about it. But since then, over the course of that 5 years, we've been able to get about 74 new wilderness areas designated as part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. That's about 2.4 million acres in those 74 areas, which is about the size of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. So it's a pretty good chunk of land, and it's for the future. It's protected permanently. So this is a gift that we'll give to future generations so that they can use and enjoy it just as we've had the opportunity to do.
And I think there's a lot of people who are really beginning to realize the incredible significance and importance of wilderness as life becomes more complex these days, and the pressures of just trying to figure out the proper path to move forward becomes clouded. There is no better place to restore and find truth than those wilderness experiences. I know you yourself have been involved in getting out to plenty of wilderness areas. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, boy. Sydney, it's really, I think, hard to pick one or two. There are so many really nice ones to be able to get out, whether to go on a raft trip or go hiking or fishing, whatever. There's a plethora of opportunities out there, and it'd be hard to pick really one or two. But I got to say that growing up, I was really enamored of the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. That was the first wilderness area that I ever visited, and so obviously that one has left a certain impression on me.
The Boundary Waters is one that I think embodies one of the purest wilderness experiences, because if you keep on going north, you're pretty much going to end up in the middle of wild, wild country. It is true wilderness. It's a unique experience.
It's nice in that regard because, yes, Quetico Superior region there, they have a provincial park on the Canadian side, so you can go across the border and into Canada, and it's, one seamless wilderness. And I think there are others around the country there. People are trying to do that. I mean, not only for the recreational opportunities, but also because wildlife really doesn't know any boundaries. And so for in the North Cascades, for instance. I think people are really interested in protecting areas on both sides of the border so that the potential for wolves and grizzly bears to go across the border is seamless. In Arizona right now, there's a great deal of concern because we have legislation that we're supporting in the two macaqueries where there used to be desert jaguars, and there have been some sightings again. But, you know, they're thinking about putting up a border fence there, and that would not only limit people from coming into the country, which I think is the intent, but also some of the wildlife. But at least, you know, on our side of the border there, we would have the habitat protected, and there would be an opportunity for the jaguar to make a comeback.
It sounds like you're optimistic, and that is certainly refreshing to hear from people working in the areas of preserving our lands. Give us a sense of what's leading to this kind of change, because I know it used to be a massive struggle, but I think you're figuring something out. And why don't you share with us what you're finding out?
Sure. We had good success in the last couple of Congresses when they were run by the Republicans. The committees were chaired by Republican members of Congress who weren't necessarily all that supportive of wilderness, but the approach that we take is to work with local partners in each of these states and, you know, get down into the communities and see what people really want for their landscapes, for their communities. And that kind of a ground-up approach has really served us well. It's engendered a lot of support among Republican members of Congress in Idaho, for instance, but elsewhere, Colorado, Oregon. And it was difficult for the leadership then to say no to these particular members of Congress who are from the same party. So we were able to pass bills, you know, even in that climate, using that kind of an approach. And we decided, well, can't argue with success, so we're going to continue to do that, even now as the Democrats have assumed the reins in Washington and have taken leadership positions on the committees with jurisdiction over public lands. This year, you know, where we had one or two or three bills in the first year that we were working on, we have 10 bills that have a viable chance this year of making it, or this Congress, and we may see a couple more added to that list by the end of it. I mean, it's really mushrooming here. It's pretty encouraging to see, and it is because it's driven locally by the county commissioners or the mayors or the chambers of commerce or the local hunting and fishing groups. It's an organic process that's burbling up to the top, and fortunately public servants in Washington are responding.
Well, that's very exciting, because I think when the wilderness system was first initiated in 1964, 43 years ago, it was much more of a top-down. There were massive areas that were set aside. But then that kind of leveled off, as you say. It's now coming from the grassroots, so it's really changed. And the significance of that is the fact that this is meeting local people's needs and desires and wants. Talk a little bit about the process of organizing and how you work with the local community to achieve this success.
Well, really what's heartening to see is that, you know, here's a case where we can make democracy work for us. We can actually make the government do the kinds of things that local people want to see, and I think that's real empowering to people. But basically what, you know, folks do in a local area is they know that there's a special spot that they've enjoyed and gone to or visited and want to make sure that it's stays that way for future generations, for their kids to be able to go and do that as well. So they maybe get together a local meeting with some other folks who've visited that area, and then they'll talk to a couple county commissioners or go to their city council and let them know that they're interested in seeing this area protected. And it kind of, you know, snowballs from there. The city council or the county commission gets involved, and then, you know, the realtors decide that this is going to help property values, and so they jump on board. The hunting and fishing groups know that there's members that they have who use those areas, so they jump on board, and it kind of builds itself up like that. And finally, it reaches the member of Congress who says, okay, you guys have developed a lot of local support here. It's not that they're not without some opposition. It's just that the overwhelming majority sentiment seems to be, let's protect this area. And the member of Congress then is enabled to step forward and introduce legislation.
You know, there's a big difference between wilderness areas typically in the West and the East, because there's a lot more open space and open land and public lands in the West than there is in the East. But I'm just curious, if you go into the eastern areas, I'm sure it's a bigger challenge to create wilderness. But what is kind of a minimum size for wilderness? How small a parcel of land can be considered? Is there a minimum?
There isn't really. I mean, if it's adjacent to some protected areas like another wilderness area or a national park, it can be anything. If it's standalone, it usually is about 1,000 acres or more. And in the West, obviously, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres that still retain their wilderness character. But even in the East, you know, we've got proposals for Virginia in the western part of the state, the Blue Ridge, that is, I think, about 40,000 acres. There's going to be a proposal introduced sometime here in the next couple of months for West Virginia. And West Virginia is a little bit bigger in size, more areas. There's a legislation introduced right now for Georgia, and we're working on a bill for the Allegheny National Forest in Pennsylvania. Last Congress, too, Sydney, a bill was passed to protect areas in Vermont and New Hampshire. So it's not just a Western thing, but as you note, most of the public lands, especially the big stretches of it, the large swaths of public land, are located in the West.
And, of course, that's where I think one of the reasons that things are changing. We'll talk a little bit about that, the changing demographics of wilderness activism, because I see a change coming. It's happening, as a matter of fact. There's a whole new variety of players that are seeing the importance of wilderness that we hadn't seen so much involved before. But on a more sort of practical, you know, looking at the landscape, in the last 8-10 years, there's been such a tremendous letting of leases for oil and gas, particularly in the West and Utah and Montana, all over the place. And I'm curious to what degree the shock value has occurred and people are beginning to realize, how is that affecting people's desire to really step up and protect their lands?
Oh, it's definitely had an impact, definitely. I mean, in Colorado, for instance, there's this unbelievable place called the Rhone Plateau, kind of in the central west part of the state. And it's historically had large numbers of elk and clear trout streams, and so the sporting community up in that area have traditionally gone there. I mean, we're talking about grandfathers taking their sons and then those fathers taking their sons, and you know, it's got a long history of that. And the fact that the Bush administration has just wholesale leased that area, and as you say, other areas across the West, whether in Utah or New Mexico or Wyoming, it's had an impact. It has definitely taken some people aback here, and conservative Republicans have come out in support of protecting these areas, so much so that, you know, the members of Congress who normally would be probably siding with the oil companies on this issue are trying to get the agencies to, slow down here a little bit. Let's take a look at what you're doing and maybe not approach it so aggressively.
In the past, there have been all sorts of real hot-button issues that drove a lot of wilderness discussion. For example, whether or not roads would be allowed in wilderness. Give us an update on kind of what's happening to some of these otherwise, these issues that in the past have raised such issues. Are they particularly like roadless areas? What's the status on that in wilderness now? Because that was so contentious.
Well, the Bush administration, when they came in, they rescinded the policy that the Forest Service had gone through a pretty lengthy public process to promulgate regulations that would have kept roads out of about a third of our national forests. And, you know, obviously roads only go into these places when they want to log them or develop them for oil and gas. And that was a pretty good balance if you think about it, one-third of the national forest being set aside as roadless. But that wasn't enough, unfortunately, for the Bush administration. So they rescinded it. It's been in the courts for the last couple of years. And the last decision was to maintain the policy as it originally was. So that third of the national forest, about 58 million acres, I think, Sydney, is protected. And they can't go in right now and develop it for roads or oil and gas or logging. But
you know, that's why those There are these battles, because it was the people who got out there and said, we just cannot allow these changes to happen, and therefore these protections are now maintained. It's so important to become involved.
It is, and that was one other thing I wanted to mention. Saturday, September 29th, is National Public Lands Day, so it's an opportunity for people to show their support for their public lands, whether it's national forests or national parks or lands that are administered by the BLM or the Fish and Wildlife Service. And there are a host of opportunities for service projects to go out and restore trails or, you know, even pick up litter in some of these places. You can get in touch with public lands folks in your region to see what kinds of events they might have Saturday to participate. And if you're looking for something to do with, you know, other people who care about these lands. And then, obviously, too, if it's, as it is with many people, kind of busy, got things to do, soccer practice to go to or whatever, there's always the ability to write a letter to your member of Congress and let them know that you support protection of public lands as wilderness, that this is America's common ground, and it's nice to be able to pass this along to future generations. That may be the easiest thing, but it's not always the most satisfying or rewarding, especially if you can get out on a nice day and help rebuild the trail.
We covered National Public Lands Day last week, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds of activities all over the country. Amazing. And it, not just a matter of going out and the wonderful things, cleaning trails and picking up debris on riverbanks and helping to paint bridges and things, but some really exciting field work, even some restoration of historic sites. This is a great opportunity for people to get out. I sense it's going to be a beautiful day, too, coming up on the 29th of September. Mike, I'd really like to hear some of the stories of your projects that are ongoing right now so that if people are listening in particular areas, they can become sensitized to what they can do. I'll go through some states. Why don't I just do that, and you might just give a brief summary of what you're working on.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. Let's start with Alaska.
In Alaska, the Bureau of Land Management owns a whole heck of a lot of realty up there on our behalf. I mean, we own it, but it administers for it. And right now they're undertaking a process where they're going to formulate land management plans that will be in effect for the next 15 years or so. So we've been working with native communities up there, some of the outlying villages, and letting them know that this process is going on and making sure that they're aware that they have the opportunity to participate in it so that they can make sure that the agency is properly considering their subsistence lifestyles and the need to protect some of these areas so that they can go hunt and fish. I mean, they don't just go to the grocery store like we do, Sydney. They actually live much like their ancestors have done over the millennium. So we want to make sure that these lands are protected for native communities' subsistence opportunities. And that's a process that we're involved in right now in Alaska.
And people can find out details on each one of these by going to www.leaveitwild.org.
That's right. That's our website, and we have each of these campaigns featured in, you know, a little bit more detail than you and I might be able to go into right now.
My effort here is to try to get people in these communities who are listening to learn more.
Get involved, exactly.
There it is. So let's talk about Arizona.
In Arizona, Representative Raul Grijalva, a Hispanic member of Congress from the southern part of the state, has introduced legislation to protect about 70,000 acres of Forest Service land down in the southern part of the state. It's magnificent. I've actually been down there and visited it, hiked up to the top of the mountain. You have some incredibly sweeping views of the surrounding Sonoran Desert. And like I said earlier, it is traditionally habitat for jaguar, and it is coming back into that area. So we'd really like to work with Representative Grijalva to ensure that that habitat is there and protected as the jaguar makes its comeback.
You know, I've been to your website and have visited each one of these write-ups on the various actions that you're working on, and I encourage people to do that because when you look at the pictures and you see the extraordinary diversity of landforms and the grandeur, it moves me when I realize just what an incredible planet we live on and how blessed we are here in the United States to have such a diversity, and the end as well, and possibly the greatest thing, the freedom, the democratic right to set these lands aside, we're very fortunate people.
It is. There are, you know, some very special places, a wide variety of them, and the opportunity for us to weigh in and make sure that they're protected as we'd like to see them protected.
How about the Golden State, California?
California, there's a lot going on. In the southern part of the state, Riverside County, there's a member of Congress, a Republican, Representative Mary Bono, who is soon to introduce legislation to protect some areas down there. In the northern part of the state, on the eastern side of the Sierras, there's another Republican member of Congress who is keen on some eastern Sierra areas that we may see legislation introduced. And then statewide, Senator Boxer has introduced a bill that includes these areas and more. And she's indicated a real willingness to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans and Democrats to, you know, incrementally protect as much as in her statewide piece of legislation.
It's very important to show your support for all sides who are involved in these processes. So be sure to write letters and let Mary Bono know that you're with her.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, Colorado, there's a lot of things happening there. The backbone of wonder in the United States, as far as I'm concerned.
Rocky Mountain National Park. We have a wilderness proposal there for almost all of the national park, which, you know, just means that there's an extra layer of protection, and people have the opportunity to go into the backcountry and know that that elk habitat is going to be just the same as it is today. It has been moving through the process, and I think we'll see that legislation enacted before the end of this Congress. And then also the brothers, Senator Salazar and his brother, Representative Salazar, are considering legislation for the central part of the state on the west side, a beautiful area called Dominguez Canyon. The Gunnison River flows by, and I actually visited that this summer. Took my five-year-old son, and we hiked back to some petroglyphs, some Native American petroglyphs, and it's just, you know, a beautiful opportunity to spend a day in the canyon walking with your son and then ultimately ending up at a place that has such historical significance. It was wonderful.
It's funny. I go through the list here, and I suddenly visit in my mind each one of these states, and I have my own personal memories, and that's really one of the great aspects of getting out to wilderness is the fact that it fills you with so much wonder inside your soul. I was thinking about Idaho and Stanley, Idaho, and the Sawtooth Mountain Range, and a feeling of, wow, timelessness that I have rarely experienced anywhere else. Talk about Idaho.
Idaho is one of those kind of stepchilds. It's not had a wilderness bill for 25 years,
wow,
not since the Frank Church River of No Return wilderness back in the mid-80s. So here's a state that is ripe for action, and thankfully a Republican member of Congress, Representative Mike Simpson, is really championing a proposal for the Boulder White Clouds Mountains in that central part of the state around Stanley that you're talking about. And it made it through the House last Congress. Unfortunately, the Senate didn't quite get to it, but Representative Simpson is as enthusiastic as ever and has been really doing everything that he needs to do to drum up support so that this Congress ultimately approves it. Meanwhile, down in the southwestern part of the state, there's a place called the Owyhee Bruneau Canyonlands, and some committee staff from Washington have gone out there and visited it, and they said, ooh, this is national park quality land. So I think they are interested in pulling together with Senator Mike Crapo a proposal for those canyon lands to protect them as part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. So, you know, here in the next couple of years, we could see some pretty big wilderness bills approved in Idaho for the first time in 25 years.
It's very interesting to hear that, for example, Mike Simpson, a conservative, is behind this, and we're hearing more and more of this, and the word conservation is based on conserve. I think what is happening is people are beginning to embrace really true, the deepest and finest values that define America. New Mexico, wow, I lived there for about 25 years. The land of enchantment. And it is that. It is a unique place. If you haven't been to New Mexico, you must go there. But there are some extraordinary examples of open space and areas that have hardly had any modern involvement with people, but certainly lots of ancient history.
There are two or three proposals right now that the New Mexico delegation is considering, one of which for the Sabinosa has been introduced by Representative Tom Udall, a name that stretches back to his dad, Stuart Udall, who was the Interior Secretary during the Kennedy administration, and then his uncle, Mo Udall, who was the chairman of the Interior Committee back when it did the Alaska Lands Act. So he's carrying on his family's tradition here in protecting wild spaces by introducing legislation to protect the Sabinosa area in northeastern New Mexico. And then down in southern New Mexico, there's a beautiful area down there by Las Cruces. All those open country desert areas that you're talking about. And in Dona Ana County, people are getting together. Here's a case where it's just amazing support. The realtors recently negotiated a compromise package with the conservationists and announced it. And so hopefully we'll see some legislation introduced there in the not-too-distant future, and this Congress has an opportunity to work through it.
Well, New Mexico is a legendary energy state, and it's best that these lands be protected now, and this is one very solid form of protection. And I think people realize that if they don't activate now, they could see those lands dramatically impacted. Oregon, I've lived there too, another state with terrific diversity from the oceans to the desert and everything in between. What's going on in Oregon?
Well, there's a iconic feature in that state, Mount Hood. The volcano, and you can't look anywhere in Portland or anywhere around Oregon without seeing it. And the senators there have gotten together and introduced legislation to protect some areas around the base of Mount Hood, and that actually has moved through committee and is awaiting floor action on the Senate side. So I feel pretty confident that that one will get enacted yet this Congress. And then just 2 weeks ago, Representative DeFazio introduced a proposal that's really been pushed quite forcefully by sportsmen, fishermen, and hunters. Trout Unlimited, for instance, is backing this one seriously. The Copper Salmon area, and it is a beautiful spot with some incredible trout streams that are just magnets for fly fishermen. And so, they've worked with their member of Congress and the local communities and come up with this proposal that enjoys a great deal of support. So I feel pretty good about that one being enacted eventually here, too.
That area around Mount Hood is almost, it's associated with Portland so directly. There's terrific amount of use by the local and expanded community there. So to set aside wilderness areas is a unique and wonderful addition to the opportunities that people have there.
That's right. We're seeing that in Washington State, too. Seattle has a place that's not but 45 minutes, an hour away in the wild Skyhomish Mountains. So there's a proposal for Wild Sky, and it has passed the House and is awaiting floor action on the Senate side. Mm. So that one may well be introduced. And then there are a couple of other proposals, one for Alpine Lakes and one for the Colville National Forest, that are being considered right now. So we could see three in the state of Washington yet this Congress.
There's a lot of open space in Washington State. Now's the time to act, to set it aside. Utah, there's areas of Utah that I think should be bubble wrapped, and just areas in canyonlands and arches and the Grand Escalante, where they're so fragile and yet so astonishingly beautiful that there's a real challenge to keep them vital and keep the beauty alive. Talk about what you're working on there.
It's interesting that you say that, bubble wrap it for the future. In the 1930s, Harold Ickes was the Interior Secretary for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he advised the president that all of southern Utah ought to be made a national park. Mm. And then obviously in the 70s we did get some national parks, but not all of southern Utah. So there's a lot of Bureau of Land Management land there, a lot of which is succumbing to oil and gas development because of this aggressive push by the agencies. And then the other huge threat is off-road vehicles. They've just really started to muck up the landscape down there, which is pretty fragile, as you know. I mean, it's a lot of sand and desert vegetation, so they can have a pretty serious impact pretty quickly. So, yeah, now is the time, I think, for folks in the state and in the delegation to get serious about discussing some of these places and seeing if there isn't room to come to agreement and get some lasting protection from these kinds of threats.
A real quick appeal to the off-roaders, too, in particularly in areas like Utah where the soil has, I believe it's called cryptobiotic. Am I right about that?
That's right. Huh?
Yeah, cryptobiotic, which is this living, little tiny, fragile surface of life that is the basis of life there. And unfortunately, when you run over that with any kind of off-road vehicle, or even put your footprint down, you disrupt it and potentially destroy it. It's really, it's a unique challenge there to protect that the soil layer from being destroyed. Well, how about Virginia?
Virginia.
We're going a little bit east now, and I know you're very busy there.
In Virginia, Representative Rick Boucher and Senator John Warner, who's retiring after the end of this Congress, have introduced in both their respective bodies a piece of legislation to establish some recreation areas so that some of the trails for mountain bikes remain open, and then also set aside some other areas as wilderness so the hikers and horseback riders and fly fishermen can go and not have the kinds of conflicts sometimes that occur when you have too much use by too many different interest groups in these areas. So it's moving along in the House, and I think I saw in some press accounts of Senator Warner's announcement that this is one of his priorities, too, before he leaves Congress. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed, but I think that's another one that we'll see head to the president's desk before the end of this Congress.
Oh, that's fabulous. You know, Michael, you're such a wonderful spokesperson for wilderness values and wilderness action. And you know as much about this as probably anybody does. So when I ask this question, I'm asking someone who can give an informed answer. Where are we in this? What do you see as our needs going into the future? Because we have to really think long range. In terms of wilderness, we better be thinking 50 years out, 25 years out, because we have to start now to be sure that these lands are protected. Where are we in this process? How much more land would you expect that we, or would hope, that we could set aside realistically?
I think that we've got a lot of life left in these campaigns. That's the beauty of the 1964 Wilderness Act, is it doesn't put any end date on this. As long as there are public lands that still qualify as affected primarily by the forces of nature with our imprint largely unnoticed, that's sort of the definition, then we can designate those areas as wilderness. So it doesn't mean that it has to have been never touched by man. There are areas in West Virginia and Virginia, for instance, that once upon a time, you know, 100 years ago, 75 years ago, were actually logged over, but the forests have returned, and so now we place a different value on them, and we've included them in the National Wilderness Preservation System. The same is true for the Wild Sky area in Washington state. That's an area that has some low elevation forests that 35, 40 years ago were logged over, but now they've come back. And so, you know, the Wilderness Act is not only an opportunity to protect lands that qualify as wilderness, but lands that have been restored. I mean, that's the magical thing about it. I think we can continue to do this so long as the society and our democratic society places an emphasis on setting some of these areas, a representative sampling of these areas, aside for future generations so that they have the opportunity to see what we've seen, the views that we've seen, the places that we've visited, you know, and that scientists have the opportunity to study some of these areas and see how they change over time, so how they're affected by forest fires, or how their wildlife populations are responding to global warming. They're wonderful natural laboratories, and I think it's just stupendous that we have this wonderful tool in the 1964 Wilderness Act.
The next time that you're out and away and you're looking across some particularly impressive and inspiring vista, it may be an appropriate time to ask yourself, is this wilderness or not? And find out. And if it's not, what do you suggest people do if they should have an interest in bringing that land forward for consideration as wilderness?
What we've seen is that people are really good about wanting to maintain the quality of life in the area where they live, especially if they've lived there for any length of time. You know, they want to see the place remain as much as it has over, you know, the time that they've been there, and keep the special qualities that attracted them there in the first place, the wide open spaces, the beautiful vistas, the clean water, the clean air. And so, you know, all it takes is talking to a few other people, a local conservation group, dropping by and seeing if there are other folks who are aware of this particular special place, and, you know, whether or not there are any threats, or is it proposed, is it recommended by the Agency for Wilderness. And that's really how it starts. It just starts with, you know, getting together with a few other people and deciding this area is important enough that I want to write a letter, I want to talk to a city councilor, I'd like to meet with my member of Congress and let him know or her know my interest in seeing this area protected. And kind of mushrooms from there. It just, you know, snowballs. One thing adds to another, and pretty soon you've got a wilderness bill that President Bush signs, which he's done in 12 different cases already since he was in there in 2000.
Well, Mike Matz, you've been very much involved in helping bring those lands to that status. Mike is the executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Mike, one more time, tell people how they can contact you.
They are certainly welcome to go to www.leaveitwild.org. And there's contact information there for folks who, you know, can help you get started, can steer you in the right direction and show you the people in your area to talk to.
And Mike, if you were to encourage people to get on National Public Lands Day, which is going to be coming up here Saturday, September 29th, What would be the words that you'd use to inspire them to get out?
Oh boy, well, here's a, you know, opportunity that we have to give something back to the land that's given us so much. So, you know, it's one day a year, take advantage of it.
Michael, I always absolutely enjoy our conversations, and we're going to do this again soon. Thanks for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Likewise, Sydney. Thanks so much.
In 1855, Chief Seattle shared his vision. We know that the white man does not understand our ways. One portion of the land is the same to him as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy. And when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves, and his children's birthright is forgotten. The sight of your cities pains the eyes of the red man, but perhaps it is because the red man is savage and does not understand. If Chief Seattle is listening, I can say that our blood runs red with his, and that in wilderness his dreams are alive. Following is a quote from the 1964 Wilderness Act. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. In Psalms in the Bible it says, where there is no vision, man will perish. And where there is? This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.